This is Willie Terry, your roaming labor correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk Network. And I'm here today at the Albany Public Library, where Professor John McGuire of Siena College gave a book review on the war before the war by Andrew DiBlanco. And I'm going to try to get words from him.
Okay, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It's a real pleasure being here again before the Friends of the Albany Public Community. But this book by Andrew DiBlanco shows us, I think, as he states, the peril of judging history by present-day standards. And I like to come back to this eventually. What he says here is, to face this fact of slavery's acceptance is to encounter one of the most demanding challenges to thinking about history. Explaining how people in the past could have failed to see what seems so clear to us in retrospect. Excuse me. This is an imperative task, but also a delicate and exacting one. On the one hand, explanation can shade into excuse. On the other hand, passing judgment on the past can be a form of self-congratulation in the present. The hard fact is that in a world where, quote, most men and nearly all women lived in some form of unfreedom, tied to one thing or another, to an indenture, an apprentice contract, land rent, a mill, workhouse or prison, husband or father, end quote, slavery was an unremarkable form of human relations. And that's particularly true. I think what Andrew DiBlanco, I've got a picture of him here, is, has always been interested in, is kind of how we conceive things in terms of morality. He's a cultural studies professor. So I think DiBlanco's argument possesses some merit in that historical context. But anyway, as he initially notes, the United States did not exist as a definite republic. I think we're so used to the idea of e pluribus unum, of the idea of the United States standing as one nation, that we often don't remember or realize that before the Civil War, there were people, not only in the South, who believed that the United States was just a loose confederation of states, that the Constitution that had been ratified by 1789 simply made the nation established by the Articles of Confederation in 1777 a tighter, better one. So there were people who believed before the Civil War that the United States was just a collection of states, that the emphasis is more on states than united. And he also argues that the issue that destroyed this prevailing conception of the Union was, of course, the increasing division over slavery. And he illustrates this general dichotomy, this widening split over slavery, by looking about how people tried to regulate the issue of fugitive slaves from 1789 until the beginning of the Civil War. And this sort of comes up is that slavery is kind of the Jane Eyre situation in the United States from 1789 through 1861. And I think that something you can also see in our contemporary history. Does anybody know what the so-called third rail of U.S. politics is? And I think this would be of a special interest to this audience.
Social Security.
Yeah, Social Security and Medicare. It's now called the third rail in American politics. Because you may know, the third rail is, of course, part of that railroad network that if you touch it, you're immediately dead because of electricity coming from the third rail. Well, Social Security and Medicare are sort of the same thing. Senior citizens are our biggest voters. Senior citizens are the ones most involved in politics. So if politicians start talking about cutting Social Security and Medicare or doing something to the system, it's like touching a third rail. And I think this is what happens with slavery from 1789 through 1861. Nobody really wants to talk about it. Everybody knows it exists out there, that it's a growing problem, but that we need to sort of put it in the faraway room, so to speak, and lock the key. But as DiBlanco continues to talk about in the book, that situation, like in the novel Jane Eyre, is bound to fail. And so what happens is that you see a continuing line of statesmen from the founding fathers to the people we'll discuss later, like Henry Clay and Stephen A. Douglas, desperately trying to contain this issue of slavery in both the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution. If you may remember, for example, Thomas Jefferson, when he wrote the Declaration of Independence with John Adams and Benjamin Franklin, had wanted to include a condemnation of slavery in the Declaration of Independence, condemning King George III for supporting the African slave trade. But John Adams and Benjamin Franklin said, no, that's probably not a good idea, because not only will you upset the Southern people, of course, Thomas Jefferson was one of those Southern people, you're also upset some of the Northerners who have made money off the slave trade. And one of the interesting facts that Del Banco brings up is that Benjamin Franklin, the very epitome of the individual in U.S. history, a man who eventually becomes the first important supporter of abolitionism, was himself a former slave owner. So this continuing containment of slavery continues in the U.S. Constitution. You may remember hearing about the Three-Fifths Compromise that came up in the U.S. Constitution, where slaves were not recognized as human beings, but for purposes of representation in Congress, they were counted individually as three-fifths of a human being to allow the Congress to be established. And this also applies to the issue of fugitive slaves, because in Article 4, Section 2, Clause 3 of the U.S. Constitution, there is a specific prohibition that states that slaves that cross state boundaries cannot earn their freedom. Excuse me. Article 4, Section 2, Clause 3 of the U.S. Constitution specifically prohibits slaves who cross state boundaries, for example, going from Virginia to Massachusetts, a free state, from claiming their non-slave status, that they're actually free now. And as usual with congressional actions or laws, there has to be more specific authorization. So by 1793, to show you how this problem is already creeping up, even 4 years after the Republic is established, in 1793, Congress passes the Fugitive Slave Law, which on one hand says if a slave owner goes north to get back his or her escaped slaves, they can do so, but only if a legal process, which includes a jury trial, determines that these are their escaped slaves. On the other hand, the Fugitive Slave Law says, 1793 says, Northerners, you cannot obstruct the slave owner's use of legal process. If a slave owner does get a jury determination, for example, that one of these escaped slaves is his or hers, you can't do anything to prevent that. So I guess this would be called sort of a half-loaf compromise. On one hand, the Southerners can come up to the North, to the free states, so-called free states, to get their escaped slaves back, but only at the price of legal process. On the other hand, Northerners cannot obstruct the use of that legal process to keep these so-called escaped slaves free. They violated the 3630 line established by the Missouri Compromise of 1820, but most importantly, for purposes of our presentation today, a new, tougher fugitive slave law was passed, which not only allow slave owners more rights in getting their escaped slaves, but also allow the use of federal law enforcement officials to aid the slave owners to get their escaped slaves, and strictly forbade any northern states from preventing the return of escaped slaves. So this is part of the Compromise of 1850. And Clay and Webster and even Calhoun are kind of keeping their fingers crossed, hoping that this will continue to keep the issue of slavery locked away, so to speak, like in the novel Jane Eyre. But of course, as Del Banco points out, this is not the case, because the years 1850 to 1860 see a heightening emotionalism over the issue of slavery, particularly concerning the return of slaves. on the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850.